from Terrascope Youth Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange, this is Fresh Greens 2.0, a youth-produced radio special about teens and the environment. I'm Elizabeth Houston.
And I'm Alexandro Zervos. Green, green, it's everywhere. From laundry soap to cars, green is the color that shouts, I'm good for the environment.
Yeah, but also I'm really good for selling more stuff to more people. Between green as an environmental virtue
and green as a handy marketing slogan, we wanted to know,
if everything is green, what does it mean? And why does all that green have some teens from across the country seeing red?
We ask youth radio groups from Portland, Maine to Seattle, Washington to pick a product or a pastime and size up its green credentials. What they learned surprised us.
Yeah, like this first piece from Zoe Scheinkoff from Weekday High at KUOW in Seattle, Washington. She followed the leftovers from a university cafeteria to a compost heap to find out what becomes of all that waste.
And to weigh the economic and environmental advantages of composting over just chucking garbage in the trash. Check it out.
Every ounce of waste that leaves my school goes straight to the landfill. Everything from the cafeteria, the halls, the classrooms, the grounds. If Sehome had composting, a lot of that waste would instead be trucked to a local facility and turned into soil. Composting is a natural process that turns once-living material back into dirt. So what does it take for compost to get from a cafeteria back into the garden? Well, first the compostable material has to make it into the right container. I'm in the Viking Commons, the cafeteria at Western Washington University in Bellingham. Most of the people are kids here for sports or music camps, but there are some college students here for summer session. I asked them what it was like adapting to Western's compost program.
It's very clearly mapped out. They have pictures of what's compostable and what's not, and all I know is they make it really easy here to use compost.
That's James McLean, a sophomore at Western.
It's slightly less convenient than putting everything, say, in the garbage. But, I mean, it's simple enough to just sort, once you're done eating, what's compostable and what's not. It's really no inconvenience at all if you have 5 seconds.
James voiced the general consensus among the students I talked to. As long as containers are clearly labeled, compostables seem to make it into the bins just fine. Jim Vale agrees. He represents the next step in the journey of compost. Jim is the guy who pulls up to Western in his big blue truck and hauls away whatever ends up in the compost bins.
Yeah, Western's pretty good. Businesses like Western or other schools that we pick up, they're really good about only compost in their cans.
To catch him for an interview, I had to be at the top of the long, steep driveway behind the Viking Commons with my bike at 7:15 a.m. I wasn't crazy about waking up early, but he didn't seem to mind it.
I just really enjoy doing this.
How come?
It just seems a lot of people really appreciate it. So that's what I get out of it.
I learned that he takes the compost to a facility in Linden, 15 miles away. By contrast, straight-up garbage is shipped 300 miles to a landfill in eastern Washington. All that unconsumed food, all the paper towels and milk cartons and napkins, ends up here. I'm at Green Earth Technologies, a composting plant in my county. I ask Stephanie Harvey, the manager of Green Earth, what's so good about compost?
Everybody benefits from composting. The students would benefit from the training that they would have in composting. Really, we're using schools as a platform to teach students how they can positively or negatively have an effect on their world. We all benefit from composting as we reduce that waste cycle. Garbage doesn't go away. We know that. We see that. We see how much we're filling landfills and how we're running out of room in landfills and what happens to garbage when there's no space to keep burying it.
At Green Earth, food waste and farm waste are shredded and mixed together to make a balanced feeding ground for microbes. Stephanie takes me out to the windy site. She shows me the gigantic compost piles covered in fabric similar to a heavy-duty raincoat. Each pile is about the size of 2 school buses end-to-end. Over 6 weeks, microbes break down the food waste. In the process, they raise the temperature in the pile to a level that kills any bacteria. Then low-energy fans cool the piles. The compost sits uncovered for another year. After that, it's ready to be bagged up as rich, healthy soil and sold for gardens and nurseries. From what I've found, compost makes sense for the environment. So why wouldn't schools feel that it makes sense for them? I asked Rod Pemble, the recycling manager at Sanitary Service in Bellingham. He helped start the Food Plus program.
Districts want to make sure that they're going to save money and that the program doesn't bring other problems to the school. Custodians have a lot of responsibilities. They want to be sure that they're not taking on a new program that's going to make a whole bunch of extra work for them. And we've demonstrated that that's possible with our program.
For one, they're not lifting heavy bags of garbage anymore because everything's on wheels. And compost does reduce costs for a school. Rod told me that his company pays a fee to unload at the compost facility, but that fee is a third of the cost of dumping garbage. Because Sanitary Service pays less for compost, schools pay less for compost service. So if compost saves the school money in the long term, has minimal cost in the short term, and has a huge environmental benefit, why is Sehome the only high school in Bellingham that doesn't have the program?
The two Bellingham high schools, which do have it currently, each had pairs of students who took this on as their senior culminating project. Every senior in Bellingham District has to have a culminating project. These students at these two high schools decided we want to champion Food Plus, we want to make it happen at our school. Because they took it on as their project, they were able to devote a lot more time to it, and that made the difference at their school. The school that does not have it currently, Sehome, has not had a group of students who championed the program, and that's really what, in our opinion, what it's going to take.
Okay, the secret's out. It's the students. The program is in place, but it won't get anywhere until everyone is on board. We have to teach each other how to use compost. But more importantly, we have to teach ourselves to care about how we impact our world.
That was Zoe Scheinkoff from Weekday High, the youth radio program at Seattle's public radio station, KUOW. Now, from an alternative to trash, to an alternative to grass.
That's right, Alex. Have you ever wondered which is better for the environment, turf or grass? Eitan Stern Robbins and Kamara Langford from Terrascope Youth Radio at MIT wanted to know and send us a story.
In every sports complex, one question always arrives.
Field turf or grass?
This question pops into the minds of many athletic directors. Each has its own advantages and disadvantages. But forgetting about the science behind them, what does the world prefer?
I prefer grass, actually. It feels more natural. We're in a city. We have a lot of artificial things around us. It's nice to have a little bit of grass when we can.
I prefer really nice natural grass, but if it's between like a kind of bad grass surface and good quality artificial turf, then I prefer turf.
It depends on what I'm doing or what sport I'm playing or I'm taking part of, but in general I prefer grass just because there's less chance of injuries for me.
I guess I prefer grass because it is natural and softer.
Regular grass. It feels better. I'm a runner. It feels better under the feet when we run afterwards. The uneven surface.
Every person has their own opinion, but what is the better choice? Each has its own benefits and disadvantages.
Dan Martin, Director of Facilities and Operations of Athletics at MIT, is an expert on the subject matter of turf and grass. He explains which is the better choice for sports teams.
The biggest thing that's critical, particularly here like at MIT, we have the largest Division III sports program in the country, as well as club sports and intramurals, is how many usable hours you can get on a field. However, when you have multiple teams and also multiple user groups where you have what's called use pressure, than many, many, you know, institutions as well as professional teams have gone to what I call synthetic grass. And because of the nature of synthetic grass with the infill that we currently have, we're able to play a lot more hours on a playable surface. So like I mentioned earlier, because of playability and heavy usage, the turf field is really the way to go for us.
Wear and tear is a major problem when it comes to grass. But even after excessive use, turf does not have this problem. But
what do the people think is better for the environment?
Probably regular grass.
I would have to say grass as well. I imagine it helps with the cooling of the environment. You know how they're putting green roofs on everything now. It sucks down a lot of the heat.
Obviously grass, because it's natural.
Contrary to popular belief, turf is more environmentally friendly.
You don't have to use pesticides or, you know, seeds and different fertilizers to maintain the turf field like you would a grass field. So from that standpoint of runoff and things like that, I think that's a real positive thing.
People think grass is more environmentally friendly, mainly because it's more natural.
In truth, turf is better because it comes from recycled materials. Grass fertilizers and pesticides can run off into surrounding water. There is still some runoff from turf, but since there's no fertilizer and pesticides in the runoff, it's not a problem.
No matter what your preference is,
turf is better than grass.
That was Kamara Langford and Eitan Stern-Robbins from Terrascope Youth Radio at MIT, an after-school program that teaches the art of radio production to teens like us.
Coming up, an Indiana teen goes all the way to China to explore the connection between the humble toilet and public and environmental health.
Whenever I visit my relatives in China, I'm struck by how modern everything looks. So imagine my surprise when I went to the other side of Shanghai, the Shantytown district.
That's when we come back. You're listening to Fresh Greens 2.0 from Terrascope Youth Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm Alexandra Zervos.
And I'm Elizabeth Houston.
Welcome back to Fresh Greens 2.0 from Terrascope Youth Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm Alexander Zervos.
And I'm Elizabeth Houston. You're listening to a youth-produced public radio special.
This hour, we're hearing from teens across the United States who are getting to the heart of what's really good for the planet, and what just might look that way.
Up next, one Maine high school student's critical take on greenwashing.
Green what-ing?
Greenwashing, the corporate practice of making green claims about products and services that might or might not live up to their marketing.
Isaac Woodbury High is a reporter from Blunt Youth Radio in Portland, Maine, a youth radio program that hosts a weekly public affairs call-in show.
Isaac took a look at Walmart's green initiatives and sent us his verdict. Take a listen.
It's not that easy being green. Having to spend each day the color of the leaves.
What is green? Wikipedia tells me that it's a synonym of environmentally friendly, used to refer to goods and services, laws, guidelines, and policies considered to inflict minimal or no harm to the environment. But what does green even mean to me? How can I be green? Am I green?
Being green. It seems you blend in with so many other ordinary
thing. I think we're at a point right now where green is certainly mainstreamed, and as things become mainstream, they kind of become meaningless. And so there's definitely a sense in which the phrase green is kind of meaningless. It doesn't really mean much anymore. That said, it's a nice catch-all phrase to get into the conversation of deeper issues, sustainability, energy efficiency. You can use the sort of the catch-all umbrella phrase of green.
The word green may be meaningless, but for someone like me who's interested in helping the environment and being green, what it comes down to is deciding which companies to give my money to. Since companies constantly bombard me with marketing messages claiming to be green, it's hard to tell who's authentic and who's not. In a park in Portland, Maine, I met with John Rooks, president of the Soap Group, a marketing firm devoted to the concepts of sustainability and social justice, that does what some might call green marketing.
one thing that I think that companies miss an opportunity in is not necessarily with green, but is with authenticity and being real about what they're talking about. Once we have authentic communications, greenwashing is impossible.
For me, greenwashing is when companies market themselves as greener than they really are. It's confusing. Greenwashing examples surround me. From the Sierra Club partnering with Clorox's GreenWorks campaign to BP, greenwashing is everywhere I look.
100% of their marketing and their brand was around this concept of alternative energy sources. I mean, they went from British Petroleum to Beyond Petroleum. So that's an example where 100% of their brand was talking about alternative energy sources, but only probably less than 5% of their business was in the alternative energy space. So that's probably the classic example of the worst case of greenwashing.
However, a number of companies are green, many for reasons having little to do with saving the environment. It has to do with efficiency, sustainability, and profits.
For all the bad that Walmart does in the world, you know, there's a lot of people that rely on those low prices, and they're taking on healthcare. And they, you know, and so if price is the issue, they're a great solution. Their sustainability initiatives have been absolutely amazing. They've done amazing, amazing things from a sustainability perspective, and they've done it very authentically because they don't greenwash. I think they've got a very, very light green campaign going on at the store level, but they don't gauge their consumer in sustainability. One, their consumer probably doesn't want it, and two, their consumer might not care. And three, they start talking about reducing the footprint of their building, the physical footprint of their building by 6%. They're doing it to save money, not to protect wildlife or anything like that. And they don't pretend. You know, they've said that. They say, we're doing all these sustainability initiatives because it saves our customers money. And that authenticity, I think, is the answer. I really, really think authenticity is the answer.
And now we're talking about consumption, backbone of America's economy. We live in a society where we have easy, cheap access to more stuff than anywhere else in the world. We're constantly feeding our consumption addiction, for example, by going to Walmart, where they have everything we could possibly want and it's all cheap. Will future generations even recognize us? Given that I'm a consumer and I'm interested in helping the environment and being green, where does this leave me? What does a green consumer look like, and does it even exist? Does it come down to substantially cutting my consumption? Most people will feel good about themselves because they buy from companies they perceive to be green, while for me, maybe it's about consuming less.
That was Isaac Woodbury High from Blunt Youth Radio in Portland, Maine. Well, Elizabeth, I must say, Isaac is persuasive, but I still think it's a good thing that corporate America is factoring the environment into the products it makes and how it markets them.
Whatever you say, Alex, but I disagree. What about all those labels that say natural and the green choice? What does that even mean? I'm inclined to think that corporate marketing just preys on consumer guilt while not actually doing much for the environment at all.
We'll let you decide how you feel about the greening of corporate America. Meanwhile, here's another pressing issue that won't soon be resolved. Clean water, and how to make sure the Earth has enough of it.
Dolna Smithback from the Youth Media Project in Santa Fe, New Mexico, sent us this next story.
Dolna traveled to the Parliament of the World's Religions in Melbourne, Australia in 2009 to find out how other nations value water and cope with its scarcity.
You know the sun and the moon and the stars up in the sky. You see the mountains and the flowers and the tree.
Each time, ladies and gentlemen, you drink water when you are thirsty, you are healing your body. Hence, you are making peace with your body.
That was Mandansa Augustine Kendewa from Zimbabwe. I've always considered myself to be water conscious. Growing up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, an area consumed by drought, I was taught a number of ways to save water. From a young age, I was told to turn off the water when I brush my teeth, to use a bucket when heating up water for a shower, and when it's yellow, to let it mellow. But while the lack of water has been present in my life, I know that I have access to more clean water than many in the world. The world water crisis is one of the largest public health issues today, with only 1% of the world's fresh water accessible to direct human use. Added to this, 1/6 of the world's population does not have access to clean water. At the Parliament of the World's Religions in Melbourne, Australia, I talked to a number of participants to hear their stories about water in relation to their religion and how they conserve water in their daily lives. The Parliament of World Religions is a global conference held every 5 years with 80 countries participating and a vast number of religions represented. They come together to discuss some of the pressing issues that we are faced with today.
All over the world, there is a water crisis situation. Because of climate change, many rivers are drying up. On the other hand, there are companies in industries that need a lot of water to function, and then they pollute also.
That was Reverend Marta Benavides of El Salvador.
So the problem with water right now is that we see that water should be recognized as a universal human right, meaning that all people have the right to have water, just like peace is a universal human right.
Marta Benavides works with local citizens and the government of El Salvador to rebuild communities that are eco-friendly. She has been active in conflict transformations and has participated in political solutions to the armed conflict in El Salvador.
What are ways that we can take care of the water here?
I think that we have to make sure that we call the Earth Mother Earth. Stop even calling it the planet. We have to recognize that we have been at war with Mother Earth, just dumping, taking, destroying. We better pay attention and know that we are destroying our very possibilities to be here, to continue to be here in the planet.
Since I was at the Parliament of the World's Religions, I was curious how water is viewed in different religions. I met two 20-year-old Muslim women from Melbourne who were part of the youth committee for the Parliament. They shared a story with me about how water plays an important part in their faith.
Water is one of the main things that we're taught to respect. There's quite a lot of rules pertaining to water usage.
There's also a lot of symbolism within our religion with water. There's the story of the wife of Abraham, Hagar. So water is actually, I wouldn't necessarily call it a sacred thing, but it is an important part of our religion.
The story of Hagar was where she was searching for water, so she ran out in the desert, and she basically was carrying her baby, which is Abraham's son, the next prophet. She was running up and down between the two mountains, Safa and Marwa, and running back and forth. She would look one way and then run to the other mountain and look the other way 7 times. And then from the in between them, a valley emerged and water sprouted out and she was able to drink fresh water. And actually, in our pilgrimage to Hajj, we performed the same 7 looking between the mountain and we actually drink from the Zamzam water.
And so, yeah, it's still sacred water. It's said when you go do the pilgrimage in Mecca and you drink from that water, all of your sins are washed away.
Another note is when we actually pray, we actually use water to cleanse ourselves, an ablution, wudu, where we actually wash our hands, face, arms, legs, or our feet more essentially, and we rinse our mouth and nose. And that's another example where water is really important, and so we're taught to value it very highly.
Since coming back from the Parliament, I have wondered, what allows for practical change to occur? Do we need to completely rethink how we look at water? How can we get the attention of the world's most politically powerful countries to make water a universal human right? Uncle Bob Randall, an elder from an indigenous group in Australia, illustrates how water is a connecting force between all living things.
There's more fluid in every living thing than any other chemical, vitamins, anything else. And that's the beauty of the water. And without water, we'll all die. So we see that water in every single one of us, it's a lifeline, it's a permanency, and it's in all living, you know, every tree, every reptile, every bird, every humans, and we need to love each other as that beautiful being.
You see the river and the sea and feel the wind that blows so free. That is where and from them all we come from. That is where and from them all you come.
That was Dolna Smithback from the Youth Media Project, which teaches and practices the craft of digital storytelling for a socially responsible world.
Now, from fresh water
to flushing water. Alex, did you know that 1 in 3 people in the world doesn't have a toilet?
No, but why am I supposed to care about that?
You should care because of the health and environmental hazards that I, for one, wouldn't have thought of. Here is Sarah Ziyang from WHJE, youth radio station in Carmel, Indiana, to tell us more.
According to the World Health Organization, lack of waste sanitation kills an estimated 2 million people a year. 2 million. That's as many people that perish because of AIDS, and twice as many as malaria's death count. So why has no one heard about our human waste problem? How our own poop kills 6,000 children a day? The answer is social taboo. I asked some of my friends to tell me about their waste disposal routines in a closed, soundproof room, and no one would tell me.
Did you just say defecation?
What kind of question is that?
What? Are you serious?
I don't want to talk about that. Okay, next question.
That question is what the WTO, the World Toilet Organization, that is trying to answer. The WTO is an agency dedicated to the proliferation of sanitary toilets and the prevention of the millions of needless deaths resulting from poor sanitation practices. And like many world health catastrophes, it is the poor and helpless that are affected the most. Our human waste problem goes hand in hand with poverty and urbanization. There are an estimated 600 million people living in Latin American squatter settlements without food, without work, without clean water, without hope. Squatter settlements exist in the periphery of a city's slums. The United Nations defines it as a rundown area of a city characterized by substandard housing, squalor, and lack of tenure security. But no amount of description or warning could prepare me for the real thing. Gleaming skyscrapers define the life of the modern city-dwelling Chinese. Whenever I visit my relatives in China, I'm struck by how modern everything looks. 10 years ago, bicycles and carts were commonplace. Today, they're gone. Walking in the main shopping district is like having a high-definition television surrounding you on all four sides. Everywhere, there's lights, there's advertisements, there's music. So imagine my surprise when I went to the other side of Shanghai, the Shantytown district. Before you even approach a Shantytown, you smell it. It's a curious, indescribable smell. A mixture of the worst diarrhea you've ever had, dried mud, and animal fat. And when you see it, the sanitation problem becomes obvious. Tracy Sun has been to one of the toilets in one of those Shantytowns.
I've been to China, and that was quite an experience. Defecating. They have squat toilets, which, if you don't know what they are, instead of a seat, you squat down. And the particular one I went to was basically just two cement blocks next to each other and on top of a hole. And the sewage system was basically non-existent. It was basically like a latrine in the woods. So everyone was dumping random stuff in it.
Everywhere there's trash, piles and piles of trash. Trash mixed with mud, and mud mixed with fecal matter. This humanization of our world sanitation problem was what really hit home for me. The disconnect became reality. But the humanization is what's most difficult for sanitation advocates. AIDS and malnutrition are easy to put a face on, but feces? There's no catchy slogan for that. The World Toilet Organization is about as good as it gets, and even that is liable to draw giggles. Sanitation is the unwanted cousin of AIDS and malnutrition relief efforts, but sanitation deserves and needs all the attention we can give it. The international community is just beginning to recognize the severity of the crisis. The United Nations declared sanitation as their 2008 advocacy theme, and the World Toilet Organization is broaching 50 member countries. But what can the average person do? This is a toiletal call to arms for the developed countries and the able. To provide sanitation for 30% of the world isn't easy. Relief efforts never are, but it is necessary. As the founder of the World Toilet Organization, Jack Sims, likes to say, we are the global voice for toilets. And by extension, we are the voice for all that cannot speak for themselves. And that is a desperately poor around the world. Besides, I think you can agree, because not having toilets is a little flushed up. Children.
That was Sarah Ziyang from WHJE, an entirely student-run radio station at Carmel High School in Carmel, Indiana.
Coming up,
we head to San Francisco, where an urban garden is being tended by some unlikely farmers.
Let's say you're poor, right? How you gonna grow food?
One little seed.
One little seed.
One.
That's all it takes.
All it takes.
One little seed is all it takes.
Unbelievable.
And we find out, to our great relief, that not everyone with good intentions is a model environmental citizen.
That's when we come back. You're listening to Fresh Greens 2.0 from Terrascope Youth Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm Elizabeth Houston.
And I'm Alexandra Zervos.
Welcome back to Fresh Greens 2.0 from Terrascope Youth Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm Elizabeth Houston.
And I'm Alexandro Zervos. You're listening to a youth-produced public radio special featuring the reporting of teens from across America about the environment.
Their impact on it and the environment's impact on them. That's certainly the story behind this next submission from Urban Sprouts in San Francisco, a group that offers garden-based educational programs.
That's right, Elizabeth. That's where teens from Log Cabin Ranch, a juvenile detention facility in San Mateo County, are learning, literally, to cultivate a new life. Urban Sprout sent us this poetry slam montage from some of the youths involved in that program.
You can learn a lot from this program.
A lot from Urban Sprouts.
Urban Sprouts
is
very important.
Cultivate the soil? Y'all let them know how you cultivate the soil.
Do you know that you can learn how to live by yourself with Urban Sprouts? Let's say you're poor, right? How you gonna grow food?
One little seed.
One little seed.
One.
That's all it takes.
All it takes.
One little seed is all it takes.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, you feel me? I never had an experience like this. I got used to all the environmental stuff. As you can see, we got a lot of plants over here. We got the peppers over there, tomatoes, and all of that. All I wanted to say was, I may be black, but most of the time brown. I'm full of soil, mix me with water, and I look like Bobby Brown. There's a lot of things made of me. For example, diamonds and rubies. Everyone calls me dirt. Thank you.
I love soil. Inside it makes me boil. So no people waste it. It's a beautiful thing. I almost want to taste it. But in spite of what it's done over for us, over the past years I face it. Dirt like no other. Love it like a brother. We should love it and care for dirt like we care for each other. Cultivation, come together as one nation. Love and anticipation. Let's stop waiting and get it done. Soil.
I want to, read you guys a very short poem. It's about this program and Urban Sprouts included. And it's my poem. This program is really easy. It ain't that hard to tell. I'm dry like a desert, listening to Samuel. I'm dirty like soil, but I shine like foil. My little buds know that no loafer is so royal. I like the things we do here and believe that's a fact, but I really want to leave and never look back.
Soil is dirty, but it saves lives. It might hurt if it gets in your eyes. It helps grow plants and it shelters for ants. Soil has a cycle. It might leave, but it's going to come back.
All right, I'm going to do this little poem. It's about green, the whole garden, man, so... I move mean for the team, I'm a fiend for the green. I got cabbage, got paper, got a pound of the trees. Purple blueberries, different colors of leaves. But when it comes to the broccoli, my favorite color is green. Got green shirts, green work, my money is green. High speeds, 18, and some of the heme. Got green apples and green candies. I got them green Skittles that'll make you beam.
I said, green is essential to my needs. I need it in my food in order to stay lean. It helps my heart, it keeps my body clean, they help me grow, yes indeed. Broccoli, carrots, lettuce, potatoes, cabbage, string beans are some of the good vegetables that I like to eat. Fruits help too, don't forget about those, plus they taste great, don't you think so? Apples, strawberries, grapes, pears, peaches, cantaloupe are some of the fruits you may catch me eating for sure. Trust me, hear me, take the time to listen, you know? It's time to start eating healthy. Please don't process this slow. So cut back on the junk food. Too much is a no-no. I just want my generation to live long. I'm going to be smooth, folks.
Green is also green. Never a reason to make someone mean. The less you eat, the more you will need. The more you eat, keep you sexy and lean. Also keep you healthy and free from disease. Out here at the ranch, I'm surrounded by green. Unfortunately, way too much green for me.
Ready? Go.
And then that's it.
Welcome, man. We know we're about to do this little rap for y'all, man, about this other spouse. How we feel about this other spouse, man. Check it. I'm going to just do a little quick one, man. My man's going to finish it off, man.
See ya.
Man. Check it. I'ma knock this out like Oscar De La Hoya. Best so clean like Matria Magnolia. Oh, yeah. The honeys out there wanna have my baby. Treat them nice and tender like Daisy.
Here you go, here you go. Big Brett Doobie. It's Sean Doobie on the scene. Rapping about the green. I'm growing these flowers and they shine like rings. If you come to my box, you gon' know what I'm talking about. Got the best one. It's the best scent ever sprout. Shooting for the green with my team like Rondo. Stay with the wine and it's green like Cosmo. I'ma just stop right there because I ain't even trying to go. But I gotta go because it's time to go.
Thank y'all, man. We're coming,
man. Down,
next time, man. Next time, man. We gonna do another one for y'all, man. Nice one, man.
Doobie, I'm out.
I'm gone.
That was a montage of voices and spoken word poetry from some of the teens involved with Urban Sprouts in San Francisco, California. That was pretty cool, Alex.
Yeah, and it made me curious to hear more about the work some of these kids from Log Cabin Ranch are doing. I invited one of the contributors to that poetry montage to talk about it with me. We're going to call him Mike, and he joins us on the line now from San Mateo County, California. Mike, welcome to Fresh Greens 2.0.
Hello, how y'all doing?
So, obviously, this garden has really been a great source of inspiration for you all. Everybody I know has loved the poetry that they heard. So, could you maybe just first describe this garden to us? What's it like?
I mean, it's a basic garden. You know, we got two community beds, which everybody works on. And then you got your own bed that you take care of personally. You know, we just make sure everything's running smoothly. The plants are watered. Everything's going good. But, yeah, that's probably, you could just imagine it, two community beds and everybody got their own little basic bed to plant whatever they want.
What do you enjoy the most about gardening?
In my opinion, it's very therapeutic. And I say that because when I'm gardening, I really just, you know, find a way to forget about everything that's going on. You know, just when I garden, you could say I just forget about all the stress that I've been going through and just take it as a therapeutic way to just relieve myself.
Do you remember the first time you ever walked to the garden? Can you maybe tell us a little bit of what you were feeling?
Yeah, actually, I had a lot of mixed feelings about the whole situation. I mean, I would always picture my grandma doing gardening. Like, it was just not my thing. You know, at first, I was very skeptical about the whole situation. I didn't really know how to confront it. But as time went on and I really tried it, I actually liked it. And actually, it's something I look forward to doing when I go home.
Do you think now, after gardening yourself, maybe you can relate a little bit to your grandma now?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. You know, I actually want to go home and just tell my grandma, like, yeah, let's go garden outside in the backyard. Let's go do something, you know, together. Because before, I would just look at her like, yeah, what are you doing? I didn't really have much to talk to her about it, like, when it came to the garden. But now I know when I go home, it's going to be, you know, in a way, we could use gardening to bond, the way I look at it.
So what do you yourself like growing?
Like, I like growing cabbage, spinach. I usually like growing vegetables, something healthy.
So what motivates you now to write poetry about the garden?
I really didn't know what motivated me. It just started coming out. I just started writing. I write on my own, on the side, so when they asked me, like, would you like to write a poem, it just kind of started coming out, and before I knew it, I had a poem.
And is there something in particular in the garden you just really like to write about, something that's inspiring you?
Yeah, the soil, you know. I like looking at the soil because that's one of the things, in my opinion, that changed the most was the soil. Just looking at it change and grow from going from nothing to dirt, and then, like, 2-3 weeks later, it was green. So that was kind of cool to me just to see that.
And do you get the chance to share your work with other people around you?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. You know, it's people that I grew up with that came here, and, you know, we just I kind of had the chance to, like, how can I say, like, kind of introduce the gardening situation to them. Because just like me, they were kind of skeptical about the whole situation. But then when they saw somebody doing it that they knew, it was more like, if I could do it, why can't they? So it was just kind of fun introducing it to them.
So what does it feel like having the opportunity to just garden with other people, just in a this relaxed environment, it seems?
I mean, that's something I probably would have never, like I said, seen myself doing, especially from people from, with people from different neighborhoods. So when I was like, when I had the chance to actually do that, it was kind of good to know that I could, you know, do something with people I don't know. You know, it just felt good. Like, it's just something I could do now with people I don't even know.
So from what I understand now, you're designing certain parts of the garden. Would you mind talking a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Like, right now, we just built a fence on the side. We got a recon on the side of it. It was just a big old grass field with nothing on there. And we tried planting some trees there before, but the deers had came and, you know, chewed up the branches. So we just decided to build a fence around, like, make just a square perimeter. So what we thought, we just build a square perimeter, like fence, wood, and then we were thinking we just put up some gates and, you know, plant things that the deer probably would get, like, just plant things so that the deer won't get to it no more.
So are there any personal lessons you think you're going to be taking away after this experience?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Patience. You know, obviously, I'm like, me, myself, personally, to be honest, I was never a patient person. So when it came to garden, I understood that patience was one was gonna be one of the keys that came to, you know, doing it. Like, I hate waiting for things. So, you know, when I waited, I couldn't see myself waiting to see a plant grow. But now that I've done it and I've seen it happen, I know in myself that I do have patience and I can wait for some, you know, just, yeah, patience, really.
Well, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guest for joining me. Mike is a teen from the Log Cabin Ranch Juvenile Detention Facility in San Mateo County, California. He is a poet and an avid gardener, and he's part of the Urban Sprouts program in San Francisco, California. Mike, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
All right, thank you.
So people give back to the environment.
And the environment gives back to them.
Very cool. But hold up, Alex. Not everyone is putting the environment first. Here's something to chew on from vegetarian Manon Bonet and vegan Liam Midgley from Terrascope Youth Radio in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Manon and Liam wanted to know if the choice they made not to eat meat, or in Liam's case, eat dairy or even wear animal products, is also the better choice for the planet.
I'm going to guess and say yes.
Please tell me that I don't have to give up meat to go green, because I think that's where I'm pulling out the chalk and drawing the line.
Before you panic, Alex, let's give Manon and Liam a listen.
How do you think your eating choices affect the environment? We looked at this in terms of vegetarianism and veganism.
Quack.
Quack, 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 quack.
What do these sounds have in common? They're all animals farmed for their meat. Vegetarians decide not to consume meat. And what about these sounds? They're the sounds of pouring milk and cracking eggs. While vegetarians often eat these animal products, vegans eat neither meat nor anything that comes from an animal.
But where does everyone else get their meat? How are animals produced in America? We spoke to a professor of agriculture at Tufts University, Tim Griffin.
In animal agriculture, especially in the United States, we produce animals in a system that brings many, many, many animals into one place, usually confined, so like a barn or a building, but it could be tens of thousands or more animals all in one spot.
The principal environmental concern, Professor Griffin told us, was surprising.
The fact that you have that many animals in one spot, you have to deal with all of the waste from those animals.
To us, it sounds more like a horror story than an environmental concern. Imagine manure lagoons.
So having containment is good. Having containment fail is bad.
Apparently, hurricanes and heavy storms can cause the lagoons to overflow or breach, leaking the manure and its nutrients into rivers, becoming a water quality issue. Fortunately, some of the manure is recycled and used as fertilizer to grow crops. But besides that, another big environmental concern is greenhouse gases. In fact, according to the World Watch Institute, livestock production and its byproducts contribute to 51% of worldwide greenhouse gas emissions.
The big sources of greenhouse gases, one is livestock related. So we get greenhouse gas emissions, especially from cattle. And that's a very difficult one because that's kind of just a natural part of having cattle.
Wait, what is he talking about?
You know, cows give off gases.
What? I don't get it.
Are you really making me say this on the radio? Come on, they gas, you know? Like...
Oh, you mean cow burps?
What if right now you're feeling a little guilty about all the animals, but you just can't bring yourself to be a vegan? Well, we also wondered if being a vegetarian is that much worse for the environment than being a vegan.
The big difference is still red meat production relative to the production of other animal products. So you could draw a distinction between, maybe producing chickens for meat versus having eggs in the diet or not having eggs in the diet. That's probably a relatively small change compared to having red meat in the diet or not having red meat.
But what if you just can't give up meat? Luckily for you, Professor Griffin told us some less drastic ways you can help.
So making conscious choices when you go to the supermarket or go to a farmer's market or what have you, there are, 100 little changes that you can make if the environmental issues are on your mind when you go shopping.
But if you decide not to be vegetarian, vegan, or eat local, think about all of those cow burps and manure lagoons, and think again.
Those were Broccoli Huggers, Manon Bonet, and Leah Midgley from Terrascope Youth Radio.
You're so mean, Alex. You should be more open-minded.
Open-mindedness has its drawbacks if it means not eating a burger.
Not to worry, Alex. There must be other weak earth lovers out there like you. Well-meaning but imperfect, wanting to be model green citizens but not quite hitting the mark all the time.
I mean, I can't be the only person in the world who takes long showers, eats meat, and leaves the TV on when nobody is watching it. Oh, for shame.
Relax. You're not alone, as Devin Dennison and Kelly Blauvelt from Weekday High in Seattle, Washington found out.
My environmental guilty pleasure would probably be not recycling.
I take really long showers.
Hairspray. Hair products.
Plastic water bottles.
Probably running the air conditioning in our house.
Probably taking long lavender-scented bubble baths.
I would not be able to give up my boat.
My environmental guilty pleasure is Starbucks coffee.
Sometimes in the morning, I don't want to use a reusable coffee container, so I use paper cups.
I always throw away yogurt containers, and they're not recyclable usually.
Well, my guilty pleasure is using our hot tub, and I can't help it, but it really relieves a lot of tension. We gotta learn to reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle.
That piece from Devin Dennison and Kelly Blauvelt from Weekday High in Seattle, Washington. Well, it's good to hear that not everyone is perfect, though I'm not sure if knowing that makes me feel better or worse about the fate of the planet.
I see what you mean, but at least teens like us are thinking about what really is green and what's not. Let's at least feel good about that.
Agreed. Well, that's almost all the time we have left this hour. Fresh Greens 2.0 is a production of Terrascope Youth Radio at MIT, New Hampshire Public Radio, and the Public Radio Exchange.
Thanks to Abby Goldstein and Andrew Perella at New Hampshire Public Radio, and to Jones Franzel from Generation PRX, a project that connects, supports, and distributes youth-made radio. Learn more at generation.prx.org.
Thanks to Ari Epstein and the staff of Terrascope Youth Radio, a collaboration between MIT and the City of Cambridge Youth Programs created with generous funding from the National Science Foundation.
Thanks also to our fellow interns at Terrascope Youth Radio, who put in a lot of work to help put this program together. Finally, thanks to our producer and editor, Kelly Horan.
You can learn more about this program, our partners, and our contributors at nhpr.org. I'm Alexander Zervos.
And I'm Elizabeth Houston. Thanks for listening.